You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this amazing event. Thank you for joining us. I'm Matthew Taylor, as you hopefully know, Chief Executive of the RSA. We're delighted to be running this event in partnership with the Health Foundation on the day when we are told, and I'm reading from the BBC website, hospitals, GPs, community services and care homes are being brought together in England to provide more joined-up care under a series of pilots, and more services will be available at GP practices. That's been announced today, and as I was saying to the panel before we came in here, I think that must be the 20th time I've heard that announcement made over the last 15 years. So it's great that it's happening, although perhaps it's not. So it's quite interesting that that should be happening on the day of this debate. We've got a brilliant panel who are here to help us tackle one of the biggest issues of public debate as we enter the run-up to the general election. The NHS, as we know, is a top priority for many people. There's a funding gap of more than £8 billion to be plugged by 2020, and it's clear that the next government, whoever that may be, will need a compelling plan to secure the future of healthcare in this country. So we've got a brilliant panel. We're going to start with Jennifer Dixon, Chief Executive of the Health Foundation, who will set the scene. We're then going to be followed. Jennifer's going to be followed by Andrew Holdenby, Director of Reform, Professor Paul Corrigan, Health Policy Advisor and currently Board Member of the Care Quality Commission, and finally we have Nick Tyrone, who is standing in for Stephen Lee from Centre Forum. Nick is Centre Forum's Associate Director of External Affairs. I have suggested, and this shows you how quick on their feet these people are, I've suggested to them the way they might want to think about this is that it is just after the election, they find themselves in a lift with the new Secretary of State for Health. They have 5 minutes to tell that new Secretary of State what they should do. So imagine if this had taken place 5 years ago and it had been Andrew Lansley, you should just have said, don't do it! Slightly controversial there. But anyway, so they've got 5 minutes in the lift with the new Secretary of State for Health to say, look, these are the things you really, really need to understand. After we've heard from the kind of policy wonks, we're then going to hear from three commentators with responses from Mary Riddell from The Telegraph, Polly Toynbee from The Guardian, and Roger Taylor, author of God Bless the NHS. So, Jennifer Dixon, please welcome her.
So thank you, Matthew, and good evening, everybody. I guess if I was in the lift with the minister, I'd be tempted to say, please just go home for a few years. But anyway, my job is not to give advice here. I'm just meant to be setting the scene. So just a few points from me. NHS is probably the number one election issue. Politicians will be clearly anxious to show themselves as safe and intelligent stewards of the NHS and in touch with the public mood. But they will also want at the same time administration defining policies that will run ahead of public opinion and that they'll probably want to reveal after the election. And these will set out a vision, usually scant details of how to get there, based on assumptions of how people and organisations behave, their own assumptions rooted more in ideology rather than experience of how to run things, and certainly not running things as complicated as healthcare. So what can we expect in the run-up and immediately post-election? That's what tonight's discussion is all about. But before we start, there's just a few pointers from me on what the politicians can't easily ignore after the election, even if they can or try to during it. So the first thing is, there is rock-solid public support for a tax-funded NHS, 89% in the last British Social Attitude Survey, across all party affiliations, even UKIP, and across all ages. Rock-solid support. 70% of the public think that the general standard of NHS care has stayed the same or improved over the last 5 years. They don't think it's in a death spiral. Satisfaction is consistently high. Half the public would be happy to receive NHS-funded care provided outside of the NHS in private providers. That's half of the population asked, even if this meant their local hospital or clinic was at risk of closure as a result. 51% of the public think that the NHS often wastes money. The more a person uses healthcare, the more they're likely to report that they think the NHS wastes money. And 60% of people say they would not be willing for the government to spend less on other public services to maintain current NHS services. That's what the public say. And and what the politicians also can't ignore is however quickly they choose to make up the deficit by constraining public spending over the next few years. The NHS is, of course, as you know, facing a huge funding gap. At the Health Foundation, we estimate this to be £65 billion per annum by 2031 if long-run productivity growth remains the same. So, finally, there's likely to be no one solution to making up this gap, this huge gap. Most of the solutions will be in the heads of those in frontline care, way out of the reach of politicians and the policies that they like to talk about the most, such as competition and choice. So how will they respond? Can they rise to these new challenges in the NHS, let alone those of coalition policies? Or will it just be business as usual? So thankfully, that's not for me to answer. I now hand over to my colleagues on the panel.
Great. Thank you very much, Jennifer. I thought that statistic that 60% of people were not willing to see cuts in other services to fund the health service is a really interesting statistic. So thank you for sharing that and your other comments with us. So next we'll turn to Andrew Holdenby, who's director of the think tank Reform. Andrew.
Thank you, Matthew. It's great to be here. It will not be business as usual. I think that's the message. And we referred earlier to Andrew Lansley having a plan, and Matthew would have said, "Well, God, don't do that." I think the truth is, before the last election, that there wasn't a plan, or there wasn't a sense of what the plan was to come after the election. Andrew Lansley hadn't made detailed speeches on what he was going to do to clinical commissioning groups and all the rest of it. But it is different this time. You know, there is a plan, as I'm sure most of us, if not all of us, know here. The NHS England five-year forward view is out. It is published. It has cross-party support. You know, there isn't another public service like it where there is a detailed prescription for the service, published, debated and agreed by all, at least the three main UK parties, that gives a roadmap to go forward. And I just think that is a good thing. You know, we know where we are. We can talk about it. There's some confidence going forward. Now, it happens to be a radical plan. You know, it says that the service should not be hidebound by necessarily its history or the way it's been organised or the kind of people it's employed. It says much more clearly, you know, that the goal is better healthcare services for patients, and if that means the existing patterns of services should change, you know, so be it. You know, the plan says let's do that. In particular, although it doesn't spell it out in so many words, it says that if we're going to treat patients quicker, identify, diagnose their problems earlier, treat them quicker, treat them more often in primary care, that means that we won't have this great wave of people going to accident and emergency units, about which we've heard so much. We won't actually have as much hospital care at all. We probably will end up having fewer hospitals in total. We'll have better developed primary care, community care, much more care happening in the home, and these sort of devices, which we're all getting used to, will help with that. Simon Stevens, the head of NHS England, said that he could imagine for young people, they might not even want to go to the GP at all. You know, they'll or in person. You know, there'll be much more online discussion. Anyway, yeah, many different things I think we'll see happening. I mean, we did a seminar recently with some postmen from Jersey, the island of Jersey, who formed a partnership with the local health service because the postmen have discovered they're actually a very good early warning system for frail elderly people. You know, postmen are there knocking on the door, good morning. You know, they're not. It's not an intrusive service, but they're just part of the community, part of the resources that the community can draw on to monitor age and well-being. So the point is, you know, it is not business as usual. We will see this service change enormously, but it is around the theme of better patient care, and you know, in the backdrop of all of this is the money. Everything that I'm saying, everything that NHS England want to do is designed to deliver better care and to save money at the same time, because providing better quality care, safer care, is cheaper because you don't have to treat the same people twice. Diagnosing people, treating them quicker is also cheaper because less people are going to go to hospitals, which are the expensive part of the system. And the last thing I'd say, I mean, I think I'm supposed to talk from, as it were, the right of this discussion, and I guess I'm making a case for value for money, so I think that does, I guess, put me on the right of the spectrum. But there, you know, there is cross-party support for this. You know, Andy Burnham is a healthcare reform revolutionary. When he says integration, he means the kind of changes to primary care, to hospitals, which I've talked about. So, yeah, it is not business as usual.
Fantastic. Thanks, Andrew. So it could be this event's about to collapse in our hands, because basically Andrew's just said, it's all right, leave it to Simon Stevens. Everything is clear and we should go firing ahead. Paul, are you going to agree with that view?
I'm certainly not going to disagree with Simon Stevens.
No.
More than me, life's worth. But, dear Secretary of State, things are much worse than even Andrew has said. He's right to say we have to change the way in which business is done, but actually the change has to be more fundamental. And speaking from the left, I'm much more concerned about value for money than the right, because I believe in value rather than just money. Therefore, what we're going to have to do in the next 5 years is actually transform the value proposition of the Health and Social Care Service. And we're going to do that the way in which many other industries and services have done that, by including the customer as a major part of creating that value proposition. And that's what we're going to do with patient, people-powered health. So in the next 5 years, we're going to be looking to ensure that we invest in patients' capacity to improve their own health, not just before they have disease, but after they have disease. We're going to invest in what is called self-management. And one of the reasons we're doing that is the crucial statistics for the proposition of the NHS is that 2/3 of the money we spend on the NHS goes on these long-term conditions. Long-term conditions that, as the title suggests, you have for a long time. And generally, you don't get better for them. And the disease burden that is there in our society and in most other societies now is a disease burden which is different from what was there 30 or 40 years ago, because people have grown older and have these diseases as they grow older. And so in most of the locations of UK, between 3 and 4% of the population consume 50% of the healthcare cost. And what that means, unfortunately for you, Secretary of State, is in the next few years, that 3 or 4% as a group of very old people is going to increase. So we cannot actually have business as usual, because there won't be enough value producers in the old style of doctors, nurses and kit is the only which value is produced at the moment in healthcare services, and we're going to have to think of ways of producing new value. And that's going to be done through patients' organisations, patients and carers playing a much bigger role in looking after their own health. One interesting statistic is if you have a long-term condition, and many in this room will have long-term conditions, you actually are looking after yourself for about 5,800 waking hours a year. That's what you do. You self-care and you self-manage. If you're really ill, you might see the NHS for 10 hours a year. And that means in those 10 hours, they could be helping you for the other 5,800 hours. If we increase the amount of value that can be provided from those 5,800 hours by just a few percentage points, by making people better at looking after themselves when they're ill, then you change the value proposition of the NHS. If you double the amount of time, the amount of productivity of those 10 hours, you don't do very much. So actually how we increase the capacity of people to look after themselves is a crucial part of what will happen in the next 5 years. Two concrete examples of that that have happened in the last few weeks. On Monday, NHS England announced the first 10,000 eight sites of integrated personal commissioning. This has been happening in social care for some time. There are 600,000 personal budgets in social care. On Monday, the NHS has announced that we'll start that process. And what that will be is people with long-term conditions, children with disabilities, people with severe mental illness will be looking after themselves and commissioning their own care. Simon Stevens has said he wants about 5 million of these. Now, that is quite a radical change, because people will be commissioning their own care and therefore will not be falling, as they are at the moment, having very fragmented care. One other interesting, a completely different, a much bigger statistic than 10,000 is that about 3 weeks ago, we hit the 1 millionth dementia friend. Dementia friends are there to help people with dementia. They are an integral part of the National Health Service. They have about a couple of hours training and are transforming the nature of dementia care. And we need dementia friends in a whole range of different long-term conditions to ensure that people have a much better capacity to look after themselves and their carers can play that much bigger role in adding value to their own healthcare.
Great. Thank you Paul, so I am beginning to think that the big issue that we're going to have to get to is it looks like there's a possibly an emerging consensus about direction. The question is, why is it that change has proven so difficult, is proving that so difficult? But we'll get on to that. Nick Tyrone, who's from the Centre Forum. Nick.
Right, thank you, Matthew. I'd like to say three basic things about the NHS and then tie it all together. They're fairly straightforward. One is that it's unbelievably popular. It's interesting that even UKIP now feel the need to sort of defend the NHS. Most people are overwhelmingly proud of it. I think there's overwhelming consensus that the majority of Britons want to keep it free at the point of service. And like Jennifer said, it's the number one issue at the election. I think the second thing is that it's currently facing unprecedented challenges in continuing to offer the high level of service. And when you look at that 60% of the public not wanting to sort of cut elsewhere to save the NHS, I think this challenge becomes quite stark. And this trend's only set to get worse in the face of an aging population. And the third thing is that, as we've seen this Parliament, actually changing anything in the NHS is very difficult. I think whatever you think about the Lansley reforms, I think one of the interesting things is I think the Labour attack that really stuck to it was the Tories promised they wouldn't reorganise the NHS, and that's what they've done. And I think that's interesting in the case of sort of how difficult it is to actually change anything about the NHS. So basically my worry is that you have a sort of negative feedback loop which sort of accumulates. The NHS sort of goes into decline, and the ability to do anything about it continues to become very politically toxic. I was rereading the David Laws chapter of the Orange Book, the slightly controversial one, for those of you who remember it. And there was one bit that really struck me, and he was talking about dentistry, and he was talking about how dentists were leaving the NHS and going into private practice. And it was interesting that sort of 10 years on, just today, John Renshaw, the chair of the British Dental Association, said today that he was suggesting that he thinks the government actually wants dentists to leave. So the basic idea is that, you know, the NHS doesn't have to worry about it anymore. And what I'm worried about is how this feeds into all sorts of things that you wouldn't call sort of primary care, and feeds into questions about what should the NHS do, what should it not do, what should it cover, what should it not cover. Centre Forum has done a lot of work on mental health. Obviously, we're concerned about that being covered. But if more things are sort of shrinking from the NHS, where does that fit in? So basically, in summary, I would just like to say that I hear all this stuff about can't be business as usual, and I would agree with that. The worry is where the political capital to change things comes from. Thank you.
Great. And I'm going to take you, I mean, I'm going to go slightly off script here and pick up your last point before I come to our commentators. Mm-hmm. Andrew and Paul, what is the single, given that you broadly agree with Simon Stevens' direction, what is the single biggest barrier that Simon faces in implementing the model that you've described? It could be consultants, it could be public opinion, it could be the unions, it could be, I don't know. What do you think is the single biggest barrier to the direction that you both seem to think is broadly right? Andrew.
Well, I'm very optimistic about it because, there's so much sort of support for it. I mean, what we might say, though, is the you know, Tony Blair's government, which I don't know if you were there still at the time, Matthew and Paul, faced your... Tony Blair referred to the forces of conservatism with the small c. And there are forces of conservatism within the NHS, the main doctors' organisation. You know, its members strongly supports change in the way medicine is delivered and better technology, but often it opposes quite strongly the changes to the way the NHS works. And the BMA and others opposed the Blair reforms. They strongly opposed the Cameron reforms. So I would. You know, they're not really talking now, but I think after the election there will be a pushback from some of those groups.
And Paul, I mean, I think if we'd proposed when we were in Number 10 integrated social and healthcare personal budgets, there would have been a revolution. So things are shifting, but what do you think is the biggest barrier?
I think the biggest problem is that everybody interprets the public's deep love for the National Health Service as being a love that's impossible, therefore we can't change it. And so the interpretation of that love is, for God's sake, leave it completely alone, whereas actually I think that's not the case. I actually think love can be something where you're actually engaged in change rather than holding things completely still. So people are frightened of the public's deep affection for the National Health Service, and I think that's a resource which we worked with and built up, actually, at the end of our government. There were more people liked the National Health Service than did at the beginning because we were challenging some of those things rather than just actually stroking it like a pussy.
Jennifer.
Yeah, I think culture and expectation of staff inside their system is a real issue. I think a lot of policies have been designed to prod the system from outside. You will do better, or there'll be regulation, there'll be payment reform, there'd be sticks of various sorts, competition. But policy hasn't been skewed towards supporting staff from within organisations to do better, giving them the tools to try and break some of these cultures. And I do think that that is a big tool that's missing out of the toolkit that really now we should address. If everyone agrees on the vision, the what, the how, I think that bit is missing.
So getting the right mix of bottom-up and top-down.
Yes, the right mix of clobber versus support. There's been a lot of clobber and not enough support.
Great. Well, thank you all for that. We'll turn now to our commentators, and we'll start first with Mary Dell from The Telegraph. Mary.
Thank you very much. So thank you, Matthew. So here I am, stuck in my lift. I've gone up about 91 floors by now, listening to the views that have been put forward and deciding what to say to this new Secretary of State for Health. I must say that I thoroughly agree with everything that's been proposed tonight, with Andrew's emphasis on primary care, the sort of proper diagnostic treatment that happens elsewhere in Europe with fewer hospitals. I hope politicians are going to be brave enough to close them down where appropriate. New technology, online appointments, all of that is hugely sensible. Similarly, Paul's point about better value for money, I particularly like the idea of integrated personal commissioning and personal budgets. And of course, I agree with Nick that changing things will be very difficult and that much more political capital is invested. So what I would say, having absorbed all this to my Secretary of State, is this won't be enough. All these things are desirable, but if you do only that, then you will fail. And the reason you will fail is that this service needs more money. It is as simple as that. What you are trying to do, if you take on the Andy Burnham orthodoxy, which everybody has and quite right too, that health and social care should be integrated, you simply cannot bolt on a well-funded, tax-funded health system to a ramshackle system of social care which people are paying through the nose and in such haphazard ways that everybody is the worse off for it. Everything demands technology, demographics, that more money is put particularly into this hugely important area. Everybody, Matthew first, I think, talked about the $8 billion funding gap. Now, Simon Stevens, if I remember correctly, actually talked about $30 billion. $8 billion is a hugely optimistic view based on all sorts of efficiencies being brought to bear. And that doesn't even take account of the $4.3 billion funding gap in social care. I would say you have to bite the bullet. You either have to bite the bullet now or you have to do it down the line when this system falls apart and breaks. But you are going to have to ask people to contribute fairly to care in their old age. My preference, and if I'm talking to Andy Burnham as Secretary of State, I know it's his, is that ultimately when the time is right, I mean, he wouldn't be in any rush on this because, of course, he's bound by his own manifesto, his own party promises. But I would suspect that I'm putting words into his mouth, perhaps. But I think many politicians from both sides would think that it's absolutely essential for social care to be funded on the same basis as the NHS, which means that the taxpayer, probably the slightly older, slightly richer taxpayer, is going to have to put their hands into their pocket and pay more taxes. That, I would say to my Secretary of State, is the bullet you have to bite. Do it now, I would advise him or her, because it will get more difficult as you go along the line.
Thank you, Mary. Polly Toynbee from The Guardian. Mary, do you agree with Mary?
I agree with Mary, absolutely. And it was I was puzzled at this sort of great praise for Simon Stevens and his excellent five-year plan without pointing out that that was the most important thing he said. I mean, $8 billion was the absolute minimum with heroic savings of another 4% a year, sort of indefinitely, which nobody thinks is achievable. He was himself really suggesting $30 billion, but he thought that sounded too big for a party to be able to swallow before an election. But if we're talking to the Secretary of State after the election, he's absolutely got to go for it. It's worth remembering that the most popular budget that there had been for 25 years was the one in which Gordon Brown said an extra penny on national insurance for the NHS. I'm not suggesting that's necessarily the right way to fund it, but it was very popular. People understood it. Wanless opened the books, looked at it, said that's what's needed, and people agreed. I've just been spending several days in a very large out-of-London hospital that has not ever been in any funding trouble up until now, 1,000 beds, absolutely on the edge. I've sat through the morning meetings with the nurses going through the bed state and through the how to spread their too few nurses around the hospitals, cramming beds into every corner. They had to close their day surgery unit to put beds in there, which has hugely backed up their cold surgery waiting lists. I mean, it's that kind of desperate. Every single ward in the place is on black. There is green, amber, red, and then black. They are sometimes have ambulances stacked up right outside. This is a really well-run hospital that has not been in this sort of trouble before. I mean, this is the state of the NHS everywhere, and many much worse than that, the ones that have traditionally had debts and problems and are less manageable. It really is in crisis, and I don't think that any Secretary of State who comes in simply has to say that loud and clear, that the money has to be forthcoming in one way or another, and I think the people will take it. I take the BSA, 60% people saying they didn't want less spent on other services, I mean they didn't want less spent on other services either. It didn't mean they want the NHS cut at all, I don't think. Health and social care putting together, as Mary says, a huge problem. It's been going on since the Griffiths report, actually since before then, of people saying we have to do that. The idea that it's going to save beds or money, putting money into the community, actually you talk to people in most of the think tanks now, those who were remarkably silent, I have to say, when the Lansley reforms went through, who now say what a disaster the Lansley reforms were, nevertheless are saying what putting more money into the community will do is reveal huge unmet need. Mm. It will eat it up. It will not release beds. If you look at Lewisham and the plan they had there for closing a lot of beds there, the demand has soared in that area, and the idea that they could have cut those beds, completely impossible, improbable. It's not true that we have more beds. Germany has many, many more. I've spent time looking at the German health system. Has many, many more beds per capita than we do. It's highly unlikely we could do with fewer beds. Most of the people in our beds are very, very old and very, very frail, need to be there. Of course, there are also blocked beds, people who need releasing into the community. That's a real problem. But I don't see any possibility of fewer beds until some point when we reach a demographic peak and we start reducing the numbers of the proportion of older people in the community no time soon. Lots of good ideas around. Many of them have been mentioned. I think Darcy is back on Darcy centres. He's right, together with Claire Gerada of the GP, saying we have to rationalise GPs, pull them together into hubs, at least in cities, maybe not everywhere. You can't have one size fits all, and have really good community centres, diagnostics and everything else. Vertical integration between hospitals and community, absolutely. Pay for care in retirement, yes. Now people can reach into their pensions. I think they should reach into a lump sum that they put into a pool that will guarantee their and everybody else's care on retirement. I think is the most accessible money to be taken from older people to pay for their own care, but to pool it so none of them are crippled by the cost of it.
Thank you, Polly. So at the moment we've got on my right reformers and on my left spenders. I know I'm going to ask you about money. I'm going to ask you about money, but in terms of emphasis, the emphasis over here is on reform. The emphasis on here is
the wrong word. Perpetual improvement for every public service, always, all the time. But reform, partly because of his think tank and partly because of certain people who use the word too much, has come to mean a radical ideological change.
Fine. Okay, that's well, different I'm going to ask people on my right about money in a moment, but not until we've heard from Roger Taylor. Roger.
Thank you, Matthew. I guess my comment would be that the problem we face in healthcare is a very, very long-term problem, and all efforts to shift the system have been notoriously difficult at actually changing the fundamental dynamics between doctors and patients and what happens in hospitals and what happens in GP surgeries. And one of the difficulties is that we face immediate short-term pressures on budgets, which tends to produce solutions that can yield cash savings in the very short term and avoid the issues that would produce the longer-term benefit. And just to take one example, I mean, the first thing Simon Stevens talks about, which Paul did touch upon, but the question of prevention and his five-year plan. And the thing about prevention is there's a tendency politically to go for the easy things, which is to put a sort of a prevention intervention on the healthcare service, and we know for a fact that that actually ends up costing the healthcare service more if they're required to screen people and then do stuff. The things that really work in terms of value for money are legislative interventions and education interventions, but things like food labelling, all the politically really difficult ones. You know, banning smoking has been by far, in public places, been by far the most cost-effective health intervention for years. So that's one issue, but those are politically difficult to do. But Simon puts right at the top of the list of things he wants to do. The second thing, I'd very much absolutely agree with what Paul was saying about empowerment being absolutely, to my mind, at the heart of the long-term solution to this issue. But again, the fear is that, you know, empowering people quickly, if they're not that keen on the idea, to save money is very difficult and doesn't really qualify as empowerment. The risk is it turns instead into sort of targets about how many patients have been given a personal budget and staff who aren't really keen on the idea of feeling forced to tell patients that they should take up options that they feel nervous about because the person telling them about it looks pretty unsettled about the whole idea. Personally, I think they are absolutely brilliant and I think it's terrific the NHS is doing it. The scary thing is trying to do this in order to meet very pressing budgetary requirements. I mean, I've just come from a session downstairs which was looking at this whole issue about a people-powered NHS. And just to give you a couple of examples, I think one of the things that makes this very scary for professionals is it does mean a genuine ceding of control that this is going to work. And I had one example that was given of somebody who had got to a point of relationship with their GP where they could say, look, I think this has come back. I'm, you know, feeling this. Can you send me another script? And the GP could email back and say, yes, right, fantastically efficient. But, of course, there's a whole question of, well, is the GP allowed to do that? Do they have to see the patient? And I can contrast that with my mother-in-law's experience, who when very frail, and you know, knew she had an infection, knew she needed antibiotics, but was required to go into hospital and to spend time and have tests, and with unfortunate consequences. So there needs to be a real handing over of power. Another example was a GP who sort of said she reckoned if patients were simply allowed to say how long they spent with the GP, ultimately, it would end up using her time more efficiently. Now, that's a pretty scary thought, but it might be true. It might actually. And there was an example from Holland where nurses have done this and have been given the freedom to spend as much time as they wish with the patient, with apparently more effective results. So it requires a genuine ceding of control, which is scary for both professionals and for patients. And on the point of view of patients, I think one of the difficulty here is to engage patients, to make them feel comfortable about having a greater say, requires very subtle ways of communicating and talking to people. And it's an area where we need a lot of innovation, and we need to bring a lot of people into that to try and make that work. Just one final point I'd make, which is I completely agree about this point about 8 billion. It just definitely needs the 8 billion, and it's going to be tough to survive just with that. But in defence of poor Andrew Lansley, whose name is so perennially cursed these days, it is worth saying the NHS England's independence did come out of that act, and how many billions it did end up wasting. That has so far is proving to be quite a good institution, having the NHS separate from the Secretary of State. So just to say that finally.
Roger, thank you for that. Now, I'll be bringing the room in a moment, but I just want to, before I do that, just go back on my right-hand side and ask about this issue of money. So, you know, the kind of conundrum is that if there's loads of money, people don't feel the need to undertake difficult reforms, but if you undertake difficult reforms and there's no money, those difficult reforms often explode in all sorts of horror stories and problems. So what is the relationship between money and reform? And do you agree with Mary... and Polly and Roger, that the direction of travel that Simon Stevens laid out can only work if it's underpinned by some significant extra resources. Jennifer?
I don't think there's any clear relationship between the extent of reform and the amount of money available. If you think about it, we've had massive upheavals in this Parliament because of the Health and Social Care Act, and we've had the lowest average real terms growth, 0.6%, since 1955. On the other hand, in the previous decade, from 2000 to 2010, we had the biggest real terms increase and also a similarly huge amount of reforms. So I don't think the two things are related. But there is a real issue about if you have, eye-watering low settlement for the NHS, which is still the case, and for the foreseeable future, how can you do that when services, as Polly says, are so under pressure? If there is no investment in new models of care that can help double run while you're developing these new models, how can you do it under such pressurised environment? So that's why we and others are arguing for something called the Transformation Fund, so that there's some capital investment at least that can be used as a one-off to try out new models of care and evaluate them and try and work. How can you, I don't see without that slack, I can't see that the that we can accelerate in the way that we do need to.
Thank you. Andrew?
Well, the first thing I'd like to say is I'm going to change the name of our think tank from Reform to the Perpetual Improvement in Public Services body. I don't want to upset Polly. We should also, I think, go back and change the name of the Great Reform Act to the Perpetual Improvement in the Suffrage Act from 1832. These things do need to be corrected. I mean, I think the thing about NHS England is that it's trying to ask the question: where can we make care better and cost less at the same time? Safer care is an absolutely classic example of that, and there are hospitals up and down the country, Manchester, for example, who have really tried to drive out errors and mistakes from the way they care for their patients, even to the level of stopping bed sores and things like that. And it's amazing the change they can get, the improvements in care. They don't get complications, they don't get patients coming back again, and it does cost less. And, you know, and looking back over longer periods of time, the way technology has changed, people stay in hospitals for much, much shorter times now. You're just staying for one or two days, or even not even staying overnight, whereas in previous decades they would stay for weeks in hospitals. And that does save money as well, because staying in hospital does cost money. And then the last thing to say is, looking across the public sector, you know, there is a huge amount of work at the moment trying to find, unsurprisingly, given the pressure on public finances, trying to find the best ways to get value out of the money that we spend. So, you know, clever ways to help families, now called troubled families, used to be called socially excluded families, where, you know, actually a huge amount of public funds can be attracted by these families from different agencies. Actually, you try and put that together better. You can provide a better service more cheaply. Tackling domestic violence, tackling rehabilitation for offenders, children in care, adoption, you know, there's all these different areas where people are finding that if you target on these, very needy, vulnerable groups who are actually expensive to the public sector, you can turn their lives around and save money. That's a more general point, but I don't think the health service would probably be all that different.
Paul?
Most professional associations in the NHS want more money to do the same thing more, and they shouldn't get it. The money that needs to go in needs to be very carefully tied to actually the new models of care and to develop new ways of creating that value. And I think that's going to be a very difficult thing. That's going to be the major most difficult thing because people will assume that any extra money is money to continue doing what we're doing at the moment, and they must not get that.
And Paul, can you respond to the specific point which always troubled me when advocating personal budgets for long-term health conditions? How do you bring together the very generous universal health offer with the very threadbare social care offer?
I think with great difficulty. And actually, in reality, as you're doing this, I'm doing stuff around the country on the Better Care Fund. When you're doing this, the universal money from the NHS starts to subsidise social care. Mm-hmm. Because actually, when you're Mrs. Jones, 85 years old, and you're getting all these people traipsing through your house, some of them are social care and some aren't, it doesn't matter to you if some of the money that used to go on a district nurse is going on a home care person, because you actually want that home care person to do that. So I think there is, at the moment, with the Better Care Fund, some cross-subsidy going on, and I think it's absolutely necessary, not just in terms of social care, but to make the NHS efficient.
Great, thank you. And Nick?
Yes, I guess the worry about cost is when we're throwing around these big numbers like $30 billion, and then we're also saying at the same time that people don't want cuts elsewhere, you sort of, where does the money come from? And I suppose you could say, well, you could remove the free at the point of care universality, so you basically say wealthier people have to pay in. Australia had a model in the 1980s where basically everybody got 85% of their care, and then at a certain point you started to pay in gradient. So the wealthier people just kicked in the last 15% as a top-up. I think, though, given what I've said before about the political capital being difficult to find, that may well be unpopular with certain groups. So that would be my worry there.
Great. Okay, let's take some points from the floor. I'm going to kind of take five at a time and then ask the panel to restrict themselves to one answer each before we go back out to the room. So starting with you, sir.
My name's John Bailey. I wanted to ask your panel what their views are about legalising euthanasia and the introduction of a sugar tax. I say that because in my clinical commissioning group, City in Hackney, we have 13,000 diabetics, 28% of whom adhere to their care plans. So 72% don't. And they're the best figures in the UK. We have 44 surgeries, 12 of them under threat because of the reduction in MPIG. So how the surgeries are going to deal with all this extra workload, I know my own surgery is overwhelmed at the moment, is beyond question. It doesn't make any sense at all what we've heard from these.
Great,
gentlemen.
Thank you. I don't think you're actually advocating that people are killed for being found eating a bounty bar, but I know the point. I get the point that you're making. Okay, so we'll go right to that corner over there.
I'm Malik Gull, Wandsworth Community Empowerment Network. Matthew, nobody's mentioned, some people have mentioned it on Twitter, but no one's actually mentioned the complete lack of diversity of people and thought in the NHS at all. I mean, just a few examples, 44% of the NHS workforce is BME, less than 2% in leadership. And if you look at our inner cities, a city like London, for example, within the next 10 years, we'll have a majority of BME community living in London. Yet right across our NHS, it's almost an entirely white middle-class board. If you look at our executives and non-executives and so on and so forth, in terms of diversity of thought, recent international evidence tells us that the healthcare industry only impacts on reducing premature death by about 10%. Behaviour change and social circumstances account for 55% of the impact on that, yet 100% of the spend is in health management paradigms. Absolutely hardly anything. And the complete conversation on the panel today is within that limited silo. So it just seems that these issues are not considered at all, not considered tonight by anybody on the panel.
Oh, thank you, and forgive us for the lack of diversity of the panel itself. It's a well-made point.
Hello, Sapna Agrawal. In terms of the transformation money needed to make real change happen, I completely agree. But over the last few years, efforts to make these changes happen haven't really been very fruitful. Health technology companies find it really hard to enter the NHS because CCGs don't have the expertise or the capacity to engage in these new models. How best could this happen? An example of this is the Prime Minister's Challenge Fund for Primary Care, that's really not been innovative or executed well.
Okay, so there's broad question about innovation, and then, yep.
Thank you, Greg Parston from Imperial. I want to pick up a point that Jennifer was talking about when, Matthew, you asked her about barriers, and direct my question perhaps to the person on the board, on the panel, who's a board member of CQC. Don Berwick last week at a World Health Summit said that after 100 years of inspection, we've learned one thing, and that inspection doesn't work. Would you suggest to the Secretary of State that we get rid of the kind of clobber that Jennifer is talking about and develop more support than inspection?
Paul, I'm reserving that question for you, Paul.
Hi, I'm Caroline Abrahams. I'm the charity director at Age UK. I think what's happened under this government...
You're not in favour of euthanasia for people eating bounty bars, are you?
No, I perhaps should make that clear.
Okay.
I think what's happened under this government is we've started to think much more about what older people's needs actually are. But actually, we're still in danger of treating all older people the same. And the good news is a lot of older people are in good health. So my mum gets a call from her GP to check she's okay. She's 86 and she's still working. She doesn't need that call. But actually, I think the next challenge is to become much more targeted in the kind of support we do offer older people. And the ones we need to help the most are the frailest who are in and out of hospital. And the good news is that, just as Andrew was saying, the Troubled Families Programme has been a big success under administrations of all colours, helping children and families. There's a very similar model built on exactly that kind of approach that Age UK is working with. It's one of the new models for care. It's in the NHS five-year forward view. It's attracting a lot of interest and support. So I wanted to support Andrew, actually, and say I think it can be done. And the good news is it's saving money and it is stopping older people needing to be in hospital so much. And we are confident that as we scale this up, it will continue to make a difference. And it's not just us. So actually, I'm wanting to be a bit of a professional optimist in what is otherwise quite a gloomy discussion.
Thank you very much. Brilliant questions, panel. I'm sure you'd agree. Roger, I'm going to start with you. Just pick one point. And as we go along, panel, if there's a point that no one else has covered and you want to cover it, that would be great, so that everyone gets some kind of answer. Roger.
I'll pick up this point about 28% of people, only 28% of people adhering to their care plan. And I think that comes back to this issue of, is it realistic to expect the GP to be the person who's going to make the patient adhere to the care plan? And that's, they've got to spend their time. It's not a very effective way of making that happen. It rather relates to this point about behaviour change as well, but also to the health technology question, in that it seems to me that there are other approaches to trying to get people to adhere, and crucially, they need to be built upon the patient's desire to comply. And going to a GP and being told to comply and being tracked and monitored are not necessarily good ways of encouraging people to want to comply, and I think that may be part of the issue.
But do we know, Roger, how to empower people?
So you want more people to come forward. What I'm suggesting is that I think their technological solutions may be a better way of trying to get people to, A, know what their situation is, to want to come forward, to being engaged in their own care, to actually understanding the importance of the care plan and to wanting to do something about it. I would also support banning advertising of suites in schools and a whole lot of other stuff. But I don't think this is a problem that basically we say GP practices are going to fix this.
Polly?
I'd like to take up the GP question. I've also been spending quite a lot of time in a GP surgery watching just how up against it they are too. And they were struggling to try and get BT to come and fit a new telephone system, most basic. This was not high tech. They hadn't even got proper wireless technology. And the amount of time that he had to keep finding between appointments to try to get through to BT again, and his manager was trying as well. It wasn't that it wasn't a well-run practice. But you realise that this model of GP practices will never, ever be able to cope with the kind of technology we need, the sort of thing we talk about, you know, Skyping, although they do emails and phone consultations a lot. But actually, you need bigger clinics. You need all of those services there. You can't have each little separate GP practice trying to commission and buy its own technology with salesmen coming in suggesting this and that. How are they to know what's best? It's a broken model,
Polly,
I think.
Hasn't it proven very hard for a very, very long time to get GPs to do what we think they ought to do?
What
is the secret to that? Do we need to nationalise them all?
I think what's interesting, you're actually reaching a point where lots of people don't want to be GPs, they don't want to run practices, more of them actually want to be salaried because they don't want the responsibility because it's such hard work running these practices, and I think it is running into the ground of its own steam. I mean, again, you don't need to do it one size fits all if some people are determined to carry on with that model. But I think if you moved quickly towards hubs, a lot of GPs would come into that, and some of them you might have to force to. But, you know, the NHS has the power to do that. They've got the money. And I think that's necessary. I think reform of GPs is high on the agenda.
Mary?
Well, I wanted to speak very briefly, Matthew, to Caroline's point about professional optimism. I mean, I think it's all too easy to, and I'm probably guilty of it myself, to foist a sense of victimhood on older people who really, really don't deserve that. I mean, I think it's absolutely true that a great many older people are coping with this resilience that younger generations can only envy. And a great deal of older people, too, don't want to end up in hospital. They don't want to end up in a care home. They don't want to end up anywhere. My own mother, who was just over 86 when she died, you know, would have had, indeed, she had in the end, to be carried feet first out of her own home where she'd lived all her life. And I think what people like that need is some limited degree of help with basic tasks, whether that's having a shower, whether it's actually someone picking up a bottle of pills and bringing them across the room to you because you can't walk very well that week or at all, perhaps. And I think if we had the sort of system that Polly was describing, where everybody pays into it, then you could get whatever amount of help you needed, great or small, and nobody would be left high and dry. But I think that your basic point is absolutely right. We're not coping here with a dependent and growing cohort of older people. These are rich contributors to society who are quite rich too, and who would be very happy to square that circle.
Well, I think I'll field John's one about legalising euthanasia, just so he gets a response. I support it. I think people, as a liberal, sort of own themselves, if you like, and I think it would need to be used sparingly, and the regulation around it would have to be fairly strict so that it wasn't used that often. But I think that, you know, people facing extremely
not just occasionally to cut the waiting list.
Precisely. No, exactly. Yes. I think that would have to be carefully monitored. But yes, I would support legalizing euthanasia. And I would just like to say that that is my personal view, not necessarily the views of my organization.
Very good. Paul, I know it's hard to, but can you respond to the fact, let's get rid of all these bloody inspectors.
The Care Quality Commission. For those that don't know, Don Berwick is an American who is sort of a modern saint. So it's quite interesting to say he's wrong. The interesting thing about inspection of hospitals in this country is when I started working in the health service in 2001, I was completely stunned that there wasn't any. And that there had been inspection in schools since the 1860s, but no one thought hospitals were the right sort of place to inspect. And so I think the inspectorate in Ofsted has improved education. It's not done it on itself. It's played a role in improving education. And I think the CQC will do the same. It'll do the same because it's not just about clobber. It is actually about constructing an analysis of what's going wrong. We've had two or three hospitals where have gone from being really quite inadequate to good in a year. Because actually, what the hospital boards have said is we've had this debate, we sort of knew this was the case, but now you've made us come to terms with it. And I actually think you need an external eye to do that. In the fullness of time, when actually every hospital is doing something like iwantgreatcare.com, then the public will be the main inspectorate. And they will actually have a different power to actually play a role in improving hospitals and improving adult care services. And with any luck, we'll get there in a few years' time, but we're not there yet.
Andrew?
Well, there's not many questions left. To the gentleman from Wandsworth, I didn't quite hear your name. I completely agree that NHS management should, you know, reflect the population and, but more importantly, take advantage of all the resources of the population to have, you know, the right ideas and new thinking. So that just must be right. I mean, and a kind of related thought, thinking about the general election and the, you know, the importance of immigration as a theme at this election, all the political parties, obviously UKIP, but the others too, are trying to sound quite tough on immigration. And, you know, that would be bad news for the NHS. I mean, last time I looked, 66% of, or no, a third of NHS staff are BME. So, you know, if we're going to have lower immigration to this country, that we would have to have a different kind of NHS.
Jennifer?
So just to say, I'm also on the board of the CQC and concur exactly with what Paul had to say. I won't be undercover. Also, to answer the question about innovation and technology, I think was asked over there. So my organisation has spent the last 12 years funding the NHS to innovate and make improvements. And the short answer to our findings have been there is absolutely no shortage of talent and mission and energy in the NHS, from staff and from patients, or whoever they are, that it's brimming with ideas. It's absolutely fantastic. And with a little bit of help, such as the help that we give them, they can make changes. Clinical teams at the front line, which is where they need to. However, they can only make changes so far inside their organisations, typically hospitals. They then abut against rigid hospital systems that need to change, often against stripped-out middle management, basic things that don't work, the BT line. You know, you're a patient, you turn up, some basic things don't work, information, communication gaps, all that kind of stuff. So that needs further support, and then in some places the leadership just doesn't get the fact that the front line can make these changes and need to be given cover. So when I talked about support as well as clobber, or maybe writing that balance, it's that kind of support that I think is totally missing in the toolkit of the policy makers at the moment. Not that they should see that all that stuff, because they're not working in the front line, but they could be crafting policies more intelligently to support the front line to get us further faster. To do that, they need to think of the NHS as being a system that needs supporting, not a series of autonomous units that are competing. So there is an issue there about the zeitgeist we've been working to for the last 15, 20 years.
I think very often the problem of public service innovation, I'll bring in another group of people now, is that genuine innovation does involve upsetting people to an extent. It involves changing things. And the problem is that innovation works in one place because you've got the constellation of political forces to allow yourself to allow that innovation. But you go next door and there's a different constellation of political forces. Yeah. And so that innovation is cutting across other things they're trying to do.
Yes.
So that's why, you know, this conundrum, why is it that good practice doesn't spread in the way that it ought to? Yes. That's, I think, part of the reason for it.
The cliche is innovation plus context equals outcome. Yeah. And if the context is different, then you might have the same innovation and it doesn't spread. The thing is to support the context more than we have done.
Precisely. Okay, so we'll take the gentleman there.
Hello, Andrew Van Dorn. The panel of almost universally said that kind of the health and social care integration agenda is a good idea, and that the pooling of budgets might also be quite a good idea to help achieve that. But with kind of the health spending being about five times as big as social care, and social care spending really, really under pressure, and having spent the last 20 to 30 years trying to get people out of inappropriate health-based care into more independent living options, what confidence do we have that the medicalisation model that exists within health isn't just going to be implemented in social care, and we're going to go back those 20 or 30 years to something that we really don't want?
Thank you. And then there's two hands here.
Joe Gannon, ex-NHS senior manager up until recently. I want to follow on, I think, from the last question. What did the panel think about the announcement about the Manchester combined authorities taking on responsibility for health? And, you know, would they be more optimistic about local regions over time actually grappling and sorting out improvements in health and the NHS more than another NHS plan?
Thank you. And then behind you.
Julian, just in the interest of bringing the discussion into the room, I wondered if any of the panel would be interested to share how they manage or improve their own self-care. It's quite abstract,
okay.
This discussion.
And then, yeah.
Marion Weatherhead, and I'm a fellow. I haven't heard anything really said about health economics. And the thing that keeps bothering me is that vitamin D tablets cost very little, but old people who are suffering from not having enough vitamin D have a lot of pain, they sleep a lot, and they need a lot of care and carers. And I just don't understand why the health service isn't looking at that issue. I think millions could be saved. I'm absolutely convinced.
Put the vitamin D in the bounty bars. That's the innovative solution that you've heard first tonight. Okay, and then there's... are you over there?
Eleanor Shovelton. Three suggestions. One is that if you wish to really empower patients and to make it in any way an equal relationship, you have to supply them with proper access to their own records. Electronic patient records are an absolute basis for any kind of reform in the future. The second is that in places like Denmark, where admittedly they have higher taxes and a smaller population, they realise that health and social care need coordinating, and you actually have your own coordinator who makes sure that integration actually happens between the two, because I can assure you, if you've ever either cared for or been a person ill enough, you get constant attention from people who never speak to each other, and the care is absolutely suboptimal. And the third suggestion, which nobody ever mentions, is that when we're talking about increasing the budget, have we looked at the amount of money we spend on compensation to people where we've made errors make fewer, you could spend the money on doing some positive things.
Fantastic. We're getting loads of policy suggestions late on in the evening.
Thanks. I'm Paul Maloney from the Society of Radiographers, and I just wanted to pick up on a point I think Jennifer was making about the need to empower frontline staff. Just one tiny little example. Radiographers are, we're very close to the situation where radiographers are going to be able to prescribe drugs. It's taken 10 years to get to that position. 10 years. And that is utterly ridiculous. For what will be just a little bit of added value and a little bit of, more cost-effective service, but it's taken 10 years. And I just wanted to make the point that I think that is the fundamental thing that everybody's got to address first, is change the culture so that professionals are put at the heart, have the opportunity to make decisions, and that there is an awful lot of waste beyond that that is just draining resources from the NHS.
Thank you. I'm going to go this way and that way and then leave Jennifer with the last word. So, Nick, first. You've got first choice.
OK. Well, I'll take the bit on Denmark was very interesting. I mean, I think actually looking at continental models can be very interesting and poses a lot of questions for the right and the left in Britain. I think looking at Denmark's system, I mean, one of the interesting things is it's often cited about on the left as having lots of positive elements, which I would agree with, but I mean, a big part of Denmark is, to some degree, some private, you know, there's privatization there, which is obviously sort of untouchable on the left in Britain. Moving to the, I like the question about what have we done.
Only
to...
Only one question, but go on, just finish this one. No, finish this one, go on.
Yeah, it was just about the because he wanted every panellist to say what they've done to improve.
Oh, yes, healthcare. Oh, no, of course, no, we're all interested in your habits.
Of course, yes, yeah. I figured, yes. Well, I've got a bad back, and actually, recently I took up yoga, which I would recommend to anybody if you have a bad back. It's very, very good.
Very good. I like this idea we all have to reveal something about our health status. Paul, I've been to some dinner at Paul's house. He serves very high-fat, high-alcohol content dinners. They're absolutely they're absolutely first-rate, but I'm not sure Simon Stevens would approve of them.
point about Andrew made back about medicalisation. If one of the outcomes of integration is that the NHS medicalises social care, then I think the whole game's up. Because actually the problem we've got is there aren't enough medics in one system, let alone bleeding them into a second system. So in a sense, the thing you've been doing for the last 20 years, which is actually breaking people out of medical models, the way in which you're suggesting it, is I think the idea that's come. So that many increasing numbers of GPs now, when you have a long-term condition, they are not just prescribing you pills, but prescribing you activity, social activity. So there is a thing called social prescribing. And actually, those activities, which are non-medicalised, are trying to mobilise what is the social and community and psychological inputs to improving people's health when they're ill, which everybody knows about. Everybody knows that if you've had a heart attack and you have no friends, the prognosis for you surviving is much worse. So we know all this about issues around medicalisation, but we just don't, as an NHS, treat that as seriously as we do a box of pills. Because of my big dinners and the vast amounts of alcohol that Matthew drinks when he comes round, one of the things that over several years ago I lost a lot of weight through walking, and actually one of the problems with that is that actually for about 50 years I've done nothing but type with my upper body, so I got arthritis 2 years ago, and the thing that I did do is I didn't go anywhere near the NHS. I was frightened of what the NHS would do to me in terms of the medicalisation model we've just been talking about here. And so I was in a lot of pain, and my dad had very bad arthritis for the last 20 years of his life, and I thought, bugger, that's it. And actually, rather than that, I've been swimming, and it's gone. I go swimming every morning, and actually there is no pain now. And the great thing about pain as a mobiliser for activity is you think about it all the time when you're swimming. Swimming's very boring, very, very boring, right? But actually, every stroke is stopping me having pain.
Great, thank you, Paul. I'm delighted to say the RSA is doing a major project on social prescribing, looking at it in a whole number of different contexts, so that's great. Andrew? Pick a question and tell us how you're improving your health.
Yeah, exactly. Manchester, perhaps. Manchester was a sort of bit bizarre event, I think, because George Osborne hasn't said a word on health throughout the entire of this Parliament, or perhaps in the entire of his political career. And they said they weren't going to do any more top-down political reorganisations of the health service. And here we are, just before a general election. He says, right, we're going to carve off a bit of the health service and give it to Manchester. And it was George Osborne. So it was a very, very surprising moment. This is a Conservative Party, and they're obviously very, very keen to build up Manchester as a sort of centre of economic growth and activity. So this is part of that. But nevertheless, I think it might work very well because of the kind of place that Manchester is. And as people here may or may not know, Manchester is a very joined up place. All the local councils all work together. The different public services all work very closely together.
Same leader and chief executive for 20 years.
But which might have helped in your... Are you saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think if I've been chipping into this question, which I am now, of course, right. But I would have said that Manchester has unique capabilities in terms of political and strategic decision-making, which other local authorities as yet can only aspire to. So Manchester, I think, is uniquely capable of dealing with those kind of powers. Other local authorities are a long way away from that. It's not a criticism, it's just that they're a long way away from that. They have to have that continuity of leadership, for example. Sorry.
That's pretty much what I was going to say.
Oh, right, sorry. I am sorry. Well, we don't know. The RSA did run the City Growth Commission, so, you know, occasionally I have to reveal that I've got a brain myself. Anyway, do you want to share...
I recently broke a toe.
It's not terribly exciting as a
revelation. No, you asked.
It's what passes for management in reform.
Yeah, okay.
That's right. Kicking people.
You could, yes, exactly.
What
no.
Are you kicking?
Yes.
It's who, not what.
I was getting into the bath.
Enough information.
Yeah, exactly. And I went to the GP about a month later, and they looked at me in complete, kind of not, well, perhaps not disgust, but a certain amount of disinterest, and said, well, it's already healed. So maybe it
just
was
just leave it and it'll solve itself. Okay, Roger.
Well, I would pick up on this Hannah's point about access to records. I just think it is, and I think it's fantastic that everybody now in this from next month will be able to take their GP record in an electronic format and download it. And that sounds really unexciting. This goes to this whole point about patient empowerment. Why would anybody want to do that? But the point is, once you've got it in that format, people can do stuff for you. So imagine you've got your own budget, you've got your own records in electronic format, that can be processed, that people can look for drug interactions or possible misdiagnoses or whatever. Suddenly, the potential expands enormously for how people might start to determine the right care for them. And just to give you an example from my own life to answer this other question that is sort of relevant to that sort of situation, in an attempt to get healthier, I run. And the most recent consequence of that has been I've injured myself by developing something called plantar fasciitis.
I've got that as well.
Yeah, it's miserable,
isn't it? It's horrible, isn't it? First thing in the morning. It's
absolutely agony. Well, no, I'm okay. But now I'm okay. And I'll tell you what happened. My neighbour had it as well.
Yeah.
So no, it's getting a bit gossipy.
It's like buying a car. Once you've got it, everyone else turns out they've got it as well.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Absolutely. Anyway, but the neighbour went to the GP, and the GP was a bit unsure what to do and decided to do a cortisone injection, which is normally like a third-line treatment after all sorts of other. But anyway, the GP, for some reason, decided to do this. And obviously the GP doesn't see that many cases like this and didn't do it very well and left her more injured than she was when she'd gone there and feeling pretty furious. And in the end, through her own researches, she identified a chap who was a podiatric surgeon, of whom there are relatively few, but who specialise in this stuff. That's all they do. And they're slightly being marginalised by orthopaedic surgeons who've successfully medicalised the whole area and kind of try to run them out of town. But he was absolutely brilliant. He ran a little clinic. It's all he did. He's looked at people's feet all day. He had a high degree of medical knowledge, and he fixed it pretty swiftly.
That's a top tip. Thank you for that. Polly.
I think one of the most radical things we've heard hinted at came from our Society of Radiographers. The breaking down of professional barriers. There are so many things that could be done by paramedical, by... I mean, I was talking to a surgeon who was rather honest the other day and said, you know, it would only take quite a short time to train somebody to do all sorts of surgery if they just did one operation over and over and over again. It's a more boring job, it's more routine... But there are lots of things in the health service that can be broken down into very specific tasks that can be taught quite quickly, not long training of a generalist kind, how to do things. And certainly many more people could prescribe it. Many more nurses could do far more than they do. We have nurse practitioners. We could have many more of them. But again, there is a sort of professional jealousy that makes people have to go through a very long training, which means setting up an enormous barrier to other people entering it when we are desperately short of people who could do these jobs. And I think you've put your finger on something that really could release creativity. I'm much more suspicious about the idea of patients all treating themselves. Frankly, I want to go to a doctor and say, "Doctor, what can you give me? What can you do for me?" And I think most patients are quite like that. And I don't particularly want to say, "I want to read my records, read it all about it on the internet and decide for myself what I want." But I do think hyper-specialism and less, you know, it requires less training, could release enormous amount of creativity and funds. As for myself, well, of course, a lifelong trying to lose weight. Sometimes do, sometimes don't. I'm again suspicious of people who say we should have a huge public education campaign on obesity. There has never been such an enormous public education program of every magazine you read, of every film star you see, of everybody everywhere saying, "Be thin, be thin, be thin. Only thin is beautiful. Fat is absurd and ridiculous." That you couldn't create a public health education campaign more targeted on making people thin, and yet they're not. And I don't know what the answer to it is, and I did know, I'd be thinner.
I eat when I'm miserable, so maybe just a lot of people are miserable. Mary.
All right, well, let me do what I think is the last outstanding question, which is give people lots of vitamin D. And I think that goes to a very important point. I'm a real believer, and GPs are so much better now at doing routine blood tests on people and actually finding out if they've got some deficiency of this, that and the other. They're relatively cheap treatments, early diagnostic treatment. As you say, often things can be rectified with a bottle of very sort of straightforward pills. I really believe that those tests should continue as money gets tighter, and I think you can save an awful lot of problems down the line, but also make people's lives immeasurably better for really very little effort and outlay. On the health thing, with the honourable exception of Polly, I think that I'm going to have to contribute to the kind of slightly smug self-preservation instinct that this panel has demonstrated, and say that I go cycling every morning. I go and ride up the North London Alps, Highgate Hill and so on, which is kind of my fetish, and I tell myself that that is a good way of keeping fit. Like Andrew, I did fall off my, not getting onto a bus, I fell off my bike and broke my hand some time ago in France and decided not to go to the nearest doctor, knowing that I would be set in plaster from the neck to the toe. And so I waited till I came home and went to UCH, by which time the same thing had happened to me. The two metacarpals had healed up. So, yeah, stay away from hospitals, I suppose, is the motto.
It seems to me to be coming to a very radical solution to this NHS problem, which is just don't use the bloody thing. OK. Jennifer, final comment from you.
Thank you so much. So a comment about medicalisation and the radiographer. So we're not alone here. All across the Western world, we're kind of reaching the high water mark of super specialisation, over medicalisation. All the thrust is this way towards hospitals and super specialised care. What we need is reverse thrust engines. What sort of would provide that reverse thrust so that we can, you know, treat people more appropriately in the community and self-care and management, all that kind of stuff. So clearly a budget squeeze helps, and that is what we've got at the moment, and person-centred care may also help. But actually there's some slightly technical things to do with financial incentives, actually, that can knit together providers and treat hospitals as a cost centre. So if you pay providers in a particular way, actually expenditure then becomes unattractive because it's a cost. And then, lo and behold, the providers start thinking very carefully, well, maybe we can give the radiographers some, you know, some more freedoms. Maybe we can have nurses starting to do this or pharmacists doing that. So, and we're seeing this, always a mistake to mention US healthcare in an NHS discussion, but nevertheless, we are seeing this in some of the big cost centres in the US, actually. There is reverse thrust of cost spending. So anyway, I think we're creeping like snail towards that. We just need some rocket boosts on that. How do I say, well, stay well? Well, I am well, touch wood. I am in the smug brigade, but I do run about 3 or 4 times a week to the Goldberg variations, and I find that's incredibly helpful and has worked so far. It's better than sleep.
Well, thank you very much. I'm going to ask you in a moment to thank the Health Foundation and thank our fantastic panel for the event. I've already answered the question about Manchester. I do run, although my running has been impaired by plantar fasciitis. I have my own example of NHS waste, which is the other day I went to see the GP, and she suggested that I've reached a certain age, I should have a rather intimate examination, and then suggested that I might want a chaperone in the room. And I, as I said to her, it's embarrassing enough that you're doing this. The idea that I'd want someone else here. So there's clearly some savings to be made. Okay, so can I ask you to thank our fantastic panel?
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.